anything. Right. Hey, guys. We are back again for another show today. And I wish I could do this like Rod Serling today for Twilight Zone for everyone who doesn't know who Rod Serling is. But I'll just read it in my normal voice instead of Rod's voice. So today we journey into a world. Now, today we journey into a world where truth meets fiction, where darkness meets light, and justice is the ultimate goal. Michael Bowker, who's right next to me right now, is a veteran investigative journalist and acclaimed author who has stared down giants, dared to reveal their secrets, and has captivated readers worldwide. Michael's not only a writer, he's gone from the fairways of would-be PGA dreams to the nerve center of power and crime, unmasking truths many wished would remain hidden. He's a seasoned storyteller with over 20 books to his name. He's written for esteemed publications, testified before the U.S. Senate, and appeared on leading TV shows. In his latest work, Michael Bowker's No Ordinary Days, it's a thrilling, eye-opening ride through his best stories. We're going to talk about some of those today. It's a testament to his tireless quest for truth, from the chilling depths of crime to the lofty heights of politics. And dang, I wish I could just say that like over and over. Michael, welcome to the show. And you know what? Here we go. I'm excited about that. Did it make you dance?
That was good. Yeah. I like that. I'm ready now.
Yeah. We are going to talk about true crime today in the realest, truest sense, you know? So let's jump in. I'm going to start with like the easy questions. I don't know, maybe none of these are easy because I'm tentative about this. So, you know, in your work, like you do true crime and you've gotten into the minds of killers, murderers, whatever you want to call them. Has this ever made you fear like for your own safety?
Good question. Not really. I've had some other things that did, but it was when I was actually up against some of the world's biggest chemical companies. That made me far more nervous.
Really?
Yeah, because the true crime guys, they have their own, I don't know, it's hard to say, but it has their own agenda. They have their own channel where they go. And I was never a part of that or anywhere close to that. They're spooky people. And if you talk to them, you're going, okay, there's another planet out there somewhere that these people come from because I don't recognize this. I mean, you get to, because you get to talk to enough people who are kind of going sideways in their life. But it's really strange because they're so different, and there's a vacancy. It's not an evil in their eyes. It's a vacancy. Have you ever seen a nature show and you see a tiger? Mm-hmm. That tiger is there. It's just a predator, and you can see it in his eyes. But how do you describe those eyes? And I haven't been able to so far, as you can tell.
Well, I don't get that. So in your mind, do you think that the people who commit the most heinous crimes, why are they doing it? What are they? Yeah,
that's like the question of, and I one of the last stories I did on the Golden State Killer, I asked, a prosecutor, I asked a defender, I asked a priest. I asked the head of the UC Davis psychiatric department, and I asked a couple other people this question, Michael. I said, is it the reason that he does what he does? Does it come from childhood abuse? Does it come from a brain malfunction like hormone or chemistry or a brain growth that shouldn't be there? Or number three, was he born evil? All of them, every one of them answered before I even got the questions out. And they all answered the same way. I was shocked. Did not expect it.
How did they answer?
They answered he was born evil.
Really?
That's hard for me to grasp. The little baby coming into the earth is evil. But I don't know how to explain that. I don't know how to explain how far off they go. Because if it was just childhood abuse, well, there are millions of kids who are abused and don't become serial killers, so that can't explain it all. I ask in my story, I said, look, we get DNA from these people who are felons. And mm-hmm. that's okay. That seems to be within the law. And I suggested that when they die, and I'm not calling for capital punishment because I don't want to have any part of that debate at all. But when they die of natural causes, shouldn't we be able to harvest their brain? This is a little rough and, you know, for today, but still, shouldn't we be able, and then take a look and say, hey, are any of these weird in the same way? Are they malfunctioned yeah. in the same way? And maybe we can learn something, but of course we're not going to do that. So I don't know. I don't have an answer for that one. And I don't know that I ever will. What makes them do what they do?
That's interesting because, you know, you get in, what was the Tom Cruise movie where they pre-predicted whether or not somebody was a killer or not? I could see people going like, let's combine the brain with the AI and see what we can figure out. That would be kind of harsh.
Well, the scary question is, well, okay, if we can see this in a very young person, what do we do next?
Right.
So I don't want to have any part of that either. I'm just going to write a story and head out of Dodge and then do a sports story next week. So I don't
there you think go. So that, do you ever like feel yourself like sympathizing with any of the people that you write about, the people who are the most heinous?
Sympathize with them or their
victims? No, with them. Like, do you ever find their backstories and go like, oh, this happened because of this and this and this, and no. I really feel sorry for them. No. Nope.
Never, not even close. And once you harm someone else, all that sympathy goes out the window as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
There's no ever an excuse to harm anyone else unless you're defending someone you love.
Gotcha. Has your outlook on society changed at all because of like all the work that you do? Do you look around and go like, yeah, that guy's a bad person. This guy's okay. Like, how do you view society because of what you do?
You know, that was really a good question. No one's ever asked me that question before. And I
appreciate
it. Damn.
Okay. There's a first. That's
out of the park. I grew up in a little Midwestern tiny town. In fact, I grew up on a farm outside town for some part of it. And I grew up with the books that my father wrote to me as my reality. I played uh-huh. with those characters that were in, the Last of the Mohicans. They were my friends. So I didn't really see life until I was six or something. I didn't see anyone else around. And I think I grew up pretty, what would you call it? Naive and in love with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I've ever lost that. It's all this work and going into, you know, Folsom Prison and all these places, which are really scary, by the way, no matter how hardened you are, no matter how much you've done this, you go, it's a different world. And they're in there. Those people are in there trying to survive from day to day. But it hasn't changed me. I think the thing that changed me was on the opposite end. It was seeing the powerful and the rich and how incredibly abusive they can be. That disappointed me more because I thought these are people who have the power to do real positive things. And instead they're using it in some cases to trade lives for profits. And I've testified in court and in front of Congress about these cases. So that I know they're real.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, disappointed the daylights out of me.
Like, so when you how many of the killers have you actually met yourself? Like, and you get to interview?
Probably four, maybe okay. five or so. But, you know, a couple of them told me very privately that they didn't do it. And they gave me the information of who did. And the person that they say did do it was so close to them that they accepted the guilt on purpose so that that person that they were close to didn't have to serve the time. So it wasn't like they were pointing at, no, Joe did it over here. And so I got the information and did the background search. And it's pretty clear to me that they were telling the truth, that they didn't do it. And so it was, but that put me in a tough spot because he had already served his time and was out. I was interviewing him at a bar. We were drinking beer. Uh-huh. And he said, I served all that time on purpose so that this person I loved wouldn't have to. And I thought, here I've got a hero on my hands. I think I can't quite prove it, but I can't also write about it because that would put that person in jeopardy because, you know, there's no statute time limitation on charging someone for murder. So it was very weird. So, yeah, but some of the guys that the murderers are, they're just flat gone. There's just no. If there is humanity in there, it would take, you know, 3 days of tunneling to get to it. And I'm sorry for them. And I'm sorry that that would happen to any human being. But your concern that they could harm people, it way overwhelms being sorry for them.
Yeah. Like, I want to stay on the psychology just for a second. Like, sure. You've talked to all these people, you've written all your books, you have delved into the minds. What do you think, other than the fact people were born with it, a lot of people, right? What do you think, anyone could just be like that person that becomes the serial killer? Or is it?
Do we all have a serial killer?
Does everyone have it in them or not? Like, I'm pretty sure I don't, but you know, there might be a switch, right?
Well, I don't know. When you were talking about somebody taking that cherry out of your...
out of my fruit cocktail.
No, I think that there is something snapped in these folks because I think there is a governor in most people. By governor, I mean something that slows down speed, like you have a governor on a golf cart. Mm-hmm. You can't go too fast down the hill because it won't let you. And I think most of us have that automatically, and won't let us harm other people unless you're in a situation where, like I say, a loved one or a friend is being has been threatened. Then the governor kind of gives way, and you do what you have to do to take care of those people because someone else is trespassing. But by and large, no, I don't think people have that, but. Other people could say, well, look at all the wars we've had. Mm-hmm. It's pretty easy to dress a guy up in a little uniform, play some great music to get him all excited about being patriotic, give him a gun, he'll shoot the hell out of somebody else just because somebody told him to.
Yeah.
And sold him a line of patriotism. And I know, I don't know, is that line of patriotism something we have to have? Or if we don't have... someone else is going to take over the country. That's probably the case. Mm-hmm. But I think human beings do have the capacity for violence. But that's a different thing. Being in the army, to me, is a different thing than being a serial killer.
Yeah,
there is a little tiny bit of an overlap in that you are causing violence. But I don't see them as the same thing at all. But could anybody become a serial killer? Absolutely not. I don't believe that.
Okay. The thing that I want to jump back to, but still ties into this, is you talked about politicians and testifying right in front of the politics, and then you've got the rich people who actually are abusing their power, right? And then at what point does it happen? And I see this in our politics a lot. You start out as the representative for people. And then all of a sudden you become the leader as if you actually are the leader of a group of people. And then you get to the point where one could get to the point where they are actually kind of sold out. They're not representing anyone. They're representing their own interest. And in your testimonies, I guess, before the U.S. Senate and stuff like that, do you ever think about that? How do these people become the ones in charge and now they are... running things, you know, is that the same as saying, okay, I'm a killer, but I'm a killer of money. I'm a killer of power, an abuser of.
yeah, they have different reasons for what they do, but it's the mm-hmm. same result for the for the person on the wrong end of the stick.
Right.
No, what you're talking about is some kind of erosion where someone starts off with positive thoughts. I'm going to become a leader, and that's what I'm going to do. And then gradually the system erodes their. I don't think it works that way very often. I've done a big study on narcissism.
Okay.
And to me, that's something that we don't talk about very often, and people get it wrong. They think narcissists are people with big egos. They're not at all. If you read about narcissism, they're people with no egos. They don't know who they are. Hmm. The myth of narcissists, and I know this isn't very funny, but it's, let me see if I can get through this. If you read the old myth, the character looks down in a pool and he sees his image in the pool and he falls in love with that image. He's not falling in love with himself. That's the critical aspect of it. He's falling in love with that image. And the only reason the only way you keep that image up is by having what's called narcissistic supply, or yes men, we used to call them, mm-hmm. who are always telling you how great you are, how fabulous you are. And if you talk to a narcissist and if you say a word like no, although, but, I don't think so, you're dropping a very small pebble into that pond and you're not thinking anything of it. And suddenly you get the narcissistic wrath and it gets right in your face and they'll get very, very angry because you have rippled that pool with your little tiny, I don't think so, but, uh-huh. and they think you know what you're doing and they're feeling threatened because suddenly the only image of themselves that they have has got ripples in it and you did it, and they can bring that wrath down on you. But narcissists are also very charismatic, most charismatic people on the planet, and so we move to them and we vote for them. And I'm not pointing anybody out in particular, but these are people who, number one thing about a narcissist is they have no empathy for anyone. Mm-hmm. Not their mothers, not their children, no one. And they can get into positions of power and then watch out. You know, and you can go through all of history from Napoleon to Hitler to all the Soviet people and the people in that run China and on and on and on. Idi Amin, all cultures have narcissists.
Yeah.
And they tend to take control. So that's a different breed of cat. I think serial killers are all narcissists as well.
That was my next question. Yeah.
No empathy for anyone. And we don't do any studies about this. Where do they come from? What causes this? We think it's caused to a large degree by abandonment when they are younger. And I can go on and on about this, but it's a study that sits there, Michael, and says, study me so that. Because you can tell a narcissist, like I can at this point, like they have blue skin. I mean, you can see them. Uh-huh. And yet people vote for them. And I said, no. We don't want them even heading up a PTA group, you know,
right.
Because they tend to destroy everybody underneath in their triangle. So that is a study that has not been done and that has been avoided because a lot of the people in power kind of know that they're going to be exposed as men behind the curtain. Mm-hmm. But it's a fascinating topic. It truly is, that really goes unstudied to a large degree.
It is. I've heard it said, and I don't remember who actually said it, that to go into politics, especially if you want to be, and I'm not pointing anyone out, president or head of the Senate or whatever, you have to be a narcissist. And I'm just wondering, is that true?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I think we've had plenty of presidents who weren't, plenty of leaders who weren't. I've known some of these leaders personally. They're good, strong people. And, no, it's just the few. But the few, and they have a tendency to come in when the country is weakest. That also holds true if you're looking for a relationship and you've just broken up with a long-term relationship and you're feeling weak and vulnerable. Boy, they can spot you. they've got this computer system and they can read you and and they'll come in and they'll be exactly who you want. They're chameleons.
It's on Match.com and you can be the guy that's programming that algorithm.
Yes. Yes. And you'll be happy for about 3 months. And then,
oh my gosh. Are there any cases that you've like have worked on, you've seen, and you felt that justice just was not served properly, either positively or negatively, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. You don't want to play with drugs.
Definitely. I mean, for example, this is very weird and it's probably put everybody get ready. This will put you to sleep immediately. Just, okay. but for example, in England, they still consider, and at least a few years ago, that asbestos is the biggest killer of men under the age of 64.
Okay.
Okay. So everybody thinks asbestos is done with in the United States. Here's a surprise. It's still not illegal to put as much asbestos as you want in any product in America.
Seriously?
Seriously. You can put as much as you want in any product and sell it out any store that you want. Now, there are laws about how to take it out of a that's what everybody goes, oh, no, asbestos. There's laws about how to take it out of old buildings and stuff. Mm-hmm. There's no laws about putting it into it. And I could win so many bar bets. I should be a very wealthy man because I could win that bar bet every time because people just won't hear it. They say, no, you're wrong. And I said, I wrote a book that Simon & Schuster published. I do know that I'm right. I testified for 40 hours in the U.S. Senate about this. It's still not illegal in America to put that product. Well, that product kills. Asbestos mm-hmm. is deadly, and it's one of the nastiest ways to die. I ran a nonprofit for asbestos victims for a while, and I could tell when I talked to a person for the first time on the phone about how long they had to live because their voice just goes. Again, I'm so sorry. I thought this was going to be I'm ready to go to the funny side. Okay. This is the side. This is the tough side. This is the side that you grow up going, you know, if I'm going to be a journalist, this is the stuff that I want to shine a light on because the people who are dying from this don't have the power, don't have the understanding, don't have the money to stand up to these people.
They don't.
No, they don't. And no, that's what I agree with me. That's what I'm trying to do. That's been my whole life. And so you do have to go into the dark side, but I try to balance my life and my career because, I have, you know, you can get what I call journalistic PTSD. Mm-hmm. You can get too close and get too, you can get not depressed. I've never gotten really depressed, but you get a little down and frustrated that these things are so simple. Michael, they're so simple. They should be fixed. And the fixes are not that difficult.
Yeah. I mean, when you see brown water coming out of your tap, there's a problem.
Yeah. And you know, I wrote speeches for Antonio Villaraigosa, who was the Speaker of the Assembly and then became a two-time mayor of Los Angeles. And I would come up with ideas because I was a consultant for him as well. And I would say, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to pay the government is going to fund all of these, what I call mentors.
Yeah.
We'd pay $175,000 a year, and they live in South Central LA, and they would each have like 7 kids under their mentorship. They wouldn't replace teachers, but they would always be there after school, walk them home. And so a kid couldn't walk a block without getting a hug. And these kids would feel safe, and these mentors would take them out to UCLA, to a dentist's office in Santa Monica, show them that life, where life could go, where their life could go, and continue to be strong. And these people would live in this, mm-hmm. in these parts of the city. The money that they would get would help bring up the entire community because they would be spending the money in these areas and just pay them a lot of money. And I got a standing ovation from the business groups in LA for that idea. But you know what? Nobody ever did anything about it.
Why? Yeah, because I, you know what? I used to live in Chicago, and I do the same. Just personally, I would do that with the kids in Cabrini. Like, I would go over and bring kids and say, let's go to eat at this restaurant so you can see how things are outside the hood, you know, and grow up positive. What happened to that idea? Because it's fabulous.
It apparently made people clap and stand up, and that's as far as it got. What I wanted to do at the point was, I mean, I always have to have funding, right? So, and this was back in the day, and I was saying, we just need to close down the war in Afghanistan because the war makes no sense. We're spending $5 billion a day. We just take that money and put it, and we declare war against poverty and pain and drugs in the inner cities across the United States instead of having a war in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. But doggone it. I got a whole bunch. I want to write a book called Solutions. And
I want, when you write that book, I want you to be on so that we can actually talk about the reasons that they're good. And you go like, Michael, how did you get from killers to funding children in the inner city? Like, because they're really tied together.
They are absolutely tied together. And that's really where your heart is. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to do this serial killer stories, but I talked to, like Golden State Killer did a lot of other things. He assaulted lots of people. So there were living victims of his. And I talked to about 15 of them, said, you know, if I do this story, is this going to bring up pain for you? Because I won't do it otherwise. And they said, no, we want you to do it. And it did lead in some ways to opening up the thing. Then they finally got him 42 years later. Wow. So anyway, but those stories and then some incredible heroic stories, Michael, most amazing heroic stories that I think even outdo the evil that are in those are all in my book, No Ordinary Days, which is at my website, 60degreespublishing.com. So there's lots of stories on both sides in that book.
Well, we definitely want people to read that. I want to read it. I want to listen to it so I can be in my car driving to California and listen to what's going on with it. That's what I want to do. I want to play a little game with you. It's called This or That. And basically, here's how the game is going to work. I'm going to ask you a question. You can answer with one or the other, but you can't choose neither or both. And you can explain yourself if you want to. You might not even need to. So I'm going to start with super, super simple questions. They'll get a little harder. And at the end, maybe they'll be thought-provoking or not. But let's start with the super easy
ones. You know, I barely got through eighth grade, so.
That's okay. You like writing in the morning or at night?
I can write in both, but probably just the morning.
Okay.
I would choose it over.
About investigative journalism or authoring books?
Oh, man. Now that I go back and forth every day. Now what I want to do, I tell you what I want to do. What I'm trying to talk myself into. Authoring books. I've been an investigative journalist. I've done like 4,500 different stories. I look at my wall and I've got all these books by Hemingway and by F. Scott Fitzgerald and by a lot of the more popular authors today. I go, Michael, you only have one novel up there. You've got to write fast. You got to get going. So I would choose authoring books at this
point. Okay. I think that's fair, right? How about writing on, and I have to go back and forth on this one myself too, but writing on a typewriter or a computer?
Oh, that's a great question. When I first started, I got off my struggles on the golf tour, which talk about funny. So anyway, the first year I was at the newspaper, we had typewriters and clackety clack. We had everybody in the same room. It just made horrendous noise. Uh-huh. And I loved it. I work better with noise. And then the next year we got computers. And I immediately loved computers far more. Mm-hmm. And everybody else complained and, I can't do this. And I said, no way. Computers is it. We don't have to white out. You know what I mean?
You know, it's interesting. I used to have the same thing about handwriting, computers, or typewriting. Gotcha. Well, not order. But I think,
but I wonder what's next.
I don't, well, talking or thinking, but
you think voice recognition and, you know, things like the Dragon software and stuff like that. Anyway, that's kind of cool. No, but it's computers.
I think actually, if you have to handwrite or type, you become a better writer because you don't want to make those mistakes. You have to think about it a little bit more before you go forward. That's just my philosophy or thinking. Even though I love computers, I do everything on it.
Yeah, I get so I can't even. I mean, I have good cursive, but if I go fast, I'm going, uh-oh.
Yeah, I got
what does that say? It's just a long line. So yuck.
One more easy one. This one will get a little harder.
Oh boy. Okay.
Fact-based reporting or creative storytelling?
Creative storytelling.
Okay.
Because you don't have anybody calling you and going, you know what? He had a beige sweater, not a white sweater.
Right.
Yeah. Oh my God. This is a story about incredible philosophy of life. And you're worried about the color of the sweater. Give me a break.
I had a boss that worried about the color of blue, and I'm like, I gotta go.
No, I love when people respond, but that kind of stuff. But when when I wrote Gods of Our Time, that's the novel that I wrote, set in Paris in 1925. I thought to myself, okay, if I got to be somewhere in my head, where do you want to be? Well, I fell in love with Paris.
Mm-hmm.
So Paris was it, and I loved the 20s. So that I said it like that, and I can bring any character I want in. They can do anything. I love that. The freedom after being pinned down to facts, you know, especially when I worked for Reader's Digest for about 10 years.
Uh-huh.
We had 200 million readers at one point. If you had something, a fact wrong, oh, good Lord.
and now, no, I cannot even imagine that.
I can have all the facts wrong. It doesn't matter. So in that regard, but I did love having the audience.
Okay. How about covering white collar crime or street crime?
Well, street crime is a lot easier to cover. What it is, what it is. You go to the police report and maybe interview a few people. Well, white collar crime can be very complicated because these people will go through, you know, three or four nonprofits, and then they'll go around and come through the Cayman Islands. So you've got to do a lot more swimming through the paperwork.
So are you asking me
which one I would rather cover?
No, I'm just, it's a thought thing, like, you know, coffee or tea. So
yeah, I would prefer actually to cover the white collar crime because it's harder to do. Fewer people are doing it. And a lot of times it has far more impact on sometimes millions of people, whereas street crime, you've got direct and sometimes very terrible effect on a few people.
Gotcha. So here's one question I should have asked you earlier, and it just popped back into my head, and I have to ask you this outside of this or that. Now that you have done this for decades and you know the ins and outs of certain crimes, do you think you could get away with a crime?
Oh, one of the most fun things I wrote was with a guy named Frank Abagnale. And this was years before anybody knew who he was.
Yeah.
And I was doing a story for Sacramento Magazine on white collar crime. And I knew I had heard about him just vaguely. I called him and we talked three times and he taught me how to write a bad check. And Sacramento County at the time would not come after you if you wrote a bad check under $999. And so, or something, amount like that. And so he taught me all about how to create this bad check. And you could do it. I mean, it wasn't that difficult. And you could just do $800 checks every day of the year. And I thought, anyway, later, Frank Abagnale sold the rights to his story, and I can't remember who made it, but it turned out to be Catch Me If You Can with DiCaprio in it and Tom Hanks, and that was his story. And so number one, I could have written all those bad checks. Didn't dawn on me until I was doing this book, No Ordinary Days, because this story I did on him is in there. And I thought, oh my God, I could have just written bad checks all day long. He also,
they weren't bad technically, right? They were only bad in someone else's mind, but according to the law, they were still bad. So. Yeah.
But he played a con on me, and I finally caught up on. I said, "You're," and he goes, "I was wondering when you were going to figure it out." So it was a lot of fun to talk to and everything.
Yeah.
But then when I looked him up last summer, I caught up with everybody that I had done stories on sometimes 25 years ago, and I caught up. And there's a section in the book called "What Happened After," mm-hmm. and so I talked to him, and I talked to some other people who knew about him. Well, a lot of what he was saying about all the cons that he ran, and that's with the basis of Catch Me If You Can, which is one of the biggest films of the year at that time, was not true. He had run a con about that.
That's funny.
It was Spielberg, I think, did the film. Well, and so I said, you know, no harm, no foul, because everybody that invested in that film made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So what do they care if that's true or not? It worked out for everybody. Everybody enjoyed the film, but he ran a con on the con.
He ran a con on the con.
And I just thought that is so funny. That's
all right. Anyway, I'll let you not answer yes or no if you could get away with the crime. And
absolutely. I could have gotten away with that one if I'd even thought about it. But I didn't think about it. But no, I'm about as crimeless.
There you go.
Yeah,
let's go back to this or that then. How about keeping secrets for a compelling story or sharing everything you know immediately?
That's a hard one without examples, but keeping secrets from a compelling story. I've had to leave stuff out all the time. Mm-hmm. And not really secrets. Here's, and maybe this is comes close to what you're saying. And I used to teach journalism a lot in different, you know, colleges. And I would always say, okay, you've got this system of justice in your hands, journalism justice. Mm-hmm. And on one hand, you've got the information. You've got information. On one hand, you've got the public good it will do to publish that information.
Right.
On the other hand, you've got the private harm that it will do to someone if you tell that information. So if the public good does not outweigh the private harm, you don't print it.
Okay.
If you're going to harm someone and there's no reason for it, then you don't print it. And I guess that's a secret. I don't know. That's a secret, but that's always the system I tried to go by. But if the public is going to be way served and this guy is going to get whacked, probably because he did something bad to harm the public, then then you got to print that.
You know, I think we're going to have to do like another entire episode on journalistic responsibility. Like, if you've got the information for WikiLeaks, do you let it out or do you keep it? Or if
that's a good one.
Yeah, we're going to do a whole show on that. We'll hold that one because
and it seems to be shifting in the winds these days, which is part of what An Ordinary Days is about. I'm kind of encouraging journalists to try to get back to the pathway of trying to be objective, mm-hmm. which be cheerleaders now for one side or the other.
There's a whole show on that. We're going to do it.
No, that's not what I was raised to do. Right. You know, what you want to do is get out the information as much as you can and then let people make up their own minds. You
right. That doesn't happen anymore. Readers. That's Walter Cronkite. We're not talking about that now.
Oh, yeah. And I interviewed Walter Cronkite.
Really?
Yeah. I sat down and we just had it. He opened the door because he knew I was coming in. This is when I was working for Reader's Digest. So I had all these readers. And hand me a glass of bourbon. Uh-huh. Says, "Come on in, Mike. Put your feet up. And let's talk a while." What am I supposed to say to that? Okay,
that would be an awesome conversation.
Two tape recorders, Michael. He was my first two tape recorder because I was terrified that one of them wasn't going to work or get banged on the plane going back to California. I still have the tape, a tape of our conversations in my sock drawer. I keep it there for good luck.
Have you digitized it yet?
No. Oh, now you've got me panicked. No, right. I haven't. But I need to. But it was very interesting conversation and shocking to a lot of journalists, and it is in the book, No Ordinary Days.
Okay, I'm on it. Let's get a little tougher with the questions, more thought-provoking. Would you rather be renowned but misunderstood, or underappreciated but accurately perceived?
Well, if I had to choose, it'd be underappreciated. Okay. I never really cared that much about. I don't know that you go into journalism where you're supposed to disappear when you do a story.
Mm-hmm.
You're not supposed to. People have trouble doing that these days. You know, they want to go, look at me, look at me, look at me. I'm a writer. I'm a journalist. I'm a online, you know, get my hair all coiffed up and get on TV. But I think that to be a real journalist, you're not looking for publicity. You're looking for, again, to try to help people don't have voices. And that should pretty much satisfy you. Now, if you ask me, Michael, do you want to be rich and famous? I'd say, you bet.
Maybe that should be my next question. Oh, man. Would you always rather be able to tell when somebody is lying or have everyone believe every word you say?
I'm sorry, what was the first question?
Would you rather always be able to tell when someone is lying?
Oh.
Or have everyone believe every word that you say?
Oh, the first one.
Okay.
One of my friends, this is when I was, I don't know if I told you this story, but when I first did the Golden State Killer story, it was like 15 years after he had done his thing. And Sacramento Magazine came to me and said, we need a hard-edged story. So I said, they hadn't caught the Golden State Killer yet. He changed Sacramento dramatically, scared the hell out of everybody. Every gun was purchased, and it turned it into a little small town to a big town. But so I went to the homicide detective's house, who had first worked on the story, and he wouldn't let me in. He started peppering me with questions through the screen door. This is like a legendary story I'm telling you. And there was a psychiatrist right next to him, and she was bang, 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 giving me questions. It took me about 30 seconds, and I realized I was a suspect.
Right, right.
Yeah. Oh, man, did I love that. But that you guys, for 15 years, you've been chasing this guy, and you think I'm a suspect. So I put my notebook under my arm, and I looked at him, and I went like this. And I said, well, maybe I am him. You're not going to know till you open the door and let me in your house. So we went in and we talked. And anyway, long story short, he's now a real close friend, has been for 30 some years. And he helped find the guy. And he has since now taught FBI interrogators and other interrogators how to tell whether someone's telling you the truth or not. And we go over it and we study that. And I've learned a great deal about that. And I think I could kind of tell at this point whether someone's telling me the truth. It's a collection of things that you do. So the next novel that I'm writing, it's kind of a crime romance, and it's going to have that information in there so that when you finish the book, you'll not only be entertained, but you'll be able to know whether your boyfriend's telling you the truth or not.
You'll have a new skill, new superpower.
But yeah, that brought it up that so I would much rather be able to tell whether someone's telling the truth, because it's a fascinating, fascinating little science.
That's awesome. I mean, here's another one. Would you rather only write about the darkest aspects of society, or only the most uplifting? I think I know what that one is, but maybe you've changed over the years.
No, without question, it'd be the uplifting.
Okay.
Yeah, without question. You read some of the old guys like Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Poe and Faulkner and a lot of these writers, and they had terrible childhoods and just awful. And so they could write about darkness right away.
Mm-hmm.
And they went right to darkness. Well, I didn't. Growing up on that little farm, there wasn't any darkness out there except, you know, a rattlesnake or two. And I didn't. Yeah. I had to learn to run. So I called my mom when she was 94. And I said, Mom, you know, you're the reason that I'm not a real famous fiction writer yet, because you didn't give me enough angst to growing up. And at 94, she said, son, you come on up here. I'll give you all the angst you want.
Oh, my God.
So I have a tendency to, well, you got to have both in a book, because no one, you know, that's life. That's a human being, is both the light and the darkness. And to be, I think, a skilled writer, you need to be able to delve into both in ways that make sense, that ways that hold, have truth. So I'm not doing a very good job answering your question. Sorry.
It's okay. It's this or that. You can choose one or the other, and you can justify.
See, I'm practicing becoming a politician.
There you go.
Not really answer your question. I'll just go around it.
I got two more for you. This one, if you could change one thing, would you prefer to change people's minds or change their actions? Or are those the same thing? Change people's minds.
Boy, what a good question. You'd have to go with actions, because that's where the danger lies. And there's also, right now, we're working on a documentary film. I also wrote a book about long COVID. Mm-hmm. And it's now they're realizing it's very similar to ME, chronic fatigue syndrome. And we're going to be doing a cool film on how to rebrand all that so into one name, so that people understand, like, polio, we got polio, cancer, mm-hmm. we got cancer. But post-acute sequelae COVID, what the is that?
Right.
So
nobody knows.
We're gonna rebrand it into one name. That's going to become the galvanizing thing. It's going to create a bridge over to our knocking on the door of Congress saying, we need the funds to create treatments and cures, because millions and millions of people have this. And so that kind of thing, I think I'm answering your question, but I kind of got lost.
The thing about this or that is that it sparks ideas, right? And if you can only choose one or the other, it's people's minds and people's actions.
We're actually trying to change people's mind by identifying this, but it's the action. And the action, and so what I was going to say is, you know, your actions can be real negative, but in this case, Michael, the actions could be the most positive that we have ever taken as a society in the last 50 years, to be able to have treatments and cures for millions of people that are suffering from this. Wow.
I think it's interesting, because I either have or still have long COVID. So I get it. And
You should be a part of it. We would welcome you. Oh my gosh. Yes.
We'll talk about that. Okay. Last question. And this one, I don't know if it's hard or easy, and if it encapsulates everything that we've talked about. So if you could expose one, would you rather expose a truth that causes pain but leads to justice, or a lie that brings comfort but perpetuates injustice?
The first one.
The truth that causes pain. Yeah.
Yeah, I have to get to justice ultimately. Mm-hmm. You just have to. Injustice is just a ridiculous thing.
Okay. Well, I will say, by the way, I have had extraordinary fun, and I've loved our conversation. And we're definitely going to have to talk again, because I'm bonding with you.
I feel the same way, Michael. And I feel like we kind of covered some darker sides than I was expecting this time. I love it, because it's part of what I do. Uh-huh. But there's more to be discovered. And I appreciate what you do. And I appreciate the questions that you came up with today. They're great.
Well, thank you. And we will definitely do this again. hold on for a second. We're going to say goodbye to the audience. And everybody check out No Ordinary Days. You can look over at 60degreespublishing.com and learn what 60 degrees is. I should have like a prize for anyone who actually looks it up and goes like, oh, that's what it is. And then they can, except I don't have a prize. So
yeah, has to do with butterflies.
There you go. It does have to do with butterflies. All right, everybody. Have a good one, and we'll catch you on the next show. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, Michael.